Welcome back to the team room, everybody. You are hanging out with Aaron and I, and then we have Chief Jeff Eichert, who is the Combat Control Career Field Functional Manager. So basically nothing happens in Combat Control without your say-so, right? You're the approval authority for anything and everything Combat Control?
Yeah, no, definitely the judge, jury, executioner of anything Combat Control.
I love how you do them up there. One-man panel. Let's start off. Let's start off strong here. Here's how it goes, guys. New sheriff in town. Hi, my name's Jeff. I run everything. And I hate you all.
That's pretty much how it comes down. You know, we try to create people in our own image. Clearly, you're not like me, so you're fired.
I'll hand over my beret and we'll call it good.
And all right. Yeah. Well, this was fun. See ya.
Yeah. Well, good, Jeff. Yeah. Appreciate you joining us. So, tell us a little bit about yourself, like how you, because you are not, you were prior Army, if I remember right.
Yep.
And, but I don't remember what you did in the Army before you head over. So give us a little bit of background about how you found yourself to be the career field functional for CCT.
Yeah, no. Well, to start at the end, right? Last man standing. No, kidding. But I joined the. I was actually an ROTC cadet for a little while, and that's what kind of got me interested in the Air Force. You know, got a flyer in the mailbox in college that freshman year that was like, "Hey, you want to shoot an M16 and throw a hand grenade?" And I was like, "Hell yeah, man!" and so this, you know, all prior to 9/11. Because we all old, but started there, right? Did MS1 and MS2 year as a freshman sophomore, Army ROTC, and was introduced to the military. You know, I don't have a military background in my family, but it was something that kind of gelled with me, the camaraderie, the kind of sense of service, you know, and then you get to, you know, watch things explode and shoot things, even as an ROTC cadet, right? So did that and actually was synced up with an Army Green Beret. He would come out and train with us. And he kind of told me at the time, 18 X-ray was not a thing, except in the National Guard. And so, you know, this dude was super impressive, humble, and just, you know, somebody that you looked up to. And I was like, well, I want to be that guy. And he was like, well, you can join the Guard and do this thing. Recommend you stay in college, though, and here's some stepping stones, right? So he's like, hey, join, you know, the program is you join the infantry, and then you go to airborne school, and then when you're ready, you go to assessment selection for the Army. And I was like, yeah, that sounds good. So I did. I enlisted in the Army National Guard in Texas as an infantryman, as an 11 Bravo, to do long-range surveillance. So I specifically sought out that kind of unit. I don't think LERSH units exist anymore. It's gone through a couple of different morphed things. It went to RISTA, Reconnaissance Surveillance Technology, and something. Anyway, but so that's what I did for the first couple of years while I was in college, and then graduated college and almost immediately deployed with the Army National Guard, which, again, 9/11 had already happened. So this was for the Iraq campaign. Different National Guard than what it is today, somewhat of a terrifying experience. Just based on, you know, these were, guys that had been in an organization, good guys, but, you know, maybe not as prepared as we should have been. So we definitely learned some lessons there, but learned a ton from the Guard. And didn't, you know, didn't know the goal still was to become a Green Beret, right? So that's what I knew. Didn't know anything really about Air Force Special Operations, you know, had heard of PJs, but my hairline couldn't support being a PJ. So I realized that maybe my voice for radio, right? I could sound calm, cool, and collected under fire on the radio. And I was like, you know, maybe there's a career field that just, you know, and then also, you know, nobody wants to be rescued by an ugly dude. And so, you know, I'm the guy that when I have my helmet on and my nods, like my helmet sits a little funny. And I was like, dude, if I'm wedding carrying somebody off the battlefield, they're going to be like, this is kind of disappointing. I thought you'd be better looking. And they're like, yeah, but I'm, dude, just listen to my voice. So I love throwing the jibes in there at the PJs, right? So,
dude, anyway, I love it. So I love it so much.
So that's how I kind of started in the Army. And then over time, you know, was introduced, had some great mentors, guys out of the Ranger Battalion, that had joined the same guard unit, guys that were in 82nd, guys 10th Mountain. So a lot of guys off active duty, great mentors that kind of steered me, introduced me to, you know, Air Force Special Operations, specifically the guys that had been in Ranger Battalion, had done the joint forcible entry rehearsals. Some of them had actually done, you know, Objective Rhino, and had, you know, jumped in on that mission and said, hey, you know, Combat Control PJ, if you want to go Green Beret, look at these other ones as well. And so I did. And it just looked at the time, you know, the JTAC qualification was something that was kind of exciting, right? I had done call for fire training and stuff in the Army, and realized, man, if you can be the guy that leverages air power on the battlefield, you can turn the tide of a battle, whether that's kinetically, through close air support or non-kinetically, right? So obviously the global access mission or the, man, you're moving, men, weapons and equipment around the battlefield, on fixed wing and rotary wing, and you're there controlling the chaos. And it can be just as chaotic, if not sometimes more chaotic than kinetic fights. So that's how I got into the Air Force. Really, I had some good mentors and, you know, from the 75th that said, hey, and it was like the trifold pamphlet, right? You know, you go to the recruiter and, you know, they'd be like, oh yeah, you can, here's this pamphlet. And you like, look at a couple of pictures and it's like a guy with a pie ball balloon, like, and then it's a guy with like a SATCOM antenna and they're all camied up and you're like, oh, that looks cool.
We need Rand to do a study on how many dudes that trifold pamphlet got, because I'll tell you, that is right. It's in our wheelhouse. You know, that is something that is near, you know, seeing Ron Thompson with those dust, wind, sand, you know, -1 goggles on a four wheeler, just looking tough, just a combat shirt, a helmet, some goggles on. You're like, this is the coolest job on the face of the planet. That trifold got so many dudes in the recruiting office. And I love the dude with the balloon too. I was like, what is this guy? And even my recruiter was like, don't worry about that guy. You want to be the PJ on the four wheeler. And I was like, all right. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I like I said, I was National Guard. So I had a real job, right? I graduated from college and I was working oil field. And then I actually separated from the National Guard, for a period of a couple months. It was hard. It was much harder than it is today. So CFM, career field manager plug, much harder, back then than it is today to cross train from another service, to cross train from within our own service. So, plug myself now, right? Like reach out if you are in a sister service, if you have separated from another service, sorry, officers, you guys are in a weird boat. But on the enlisted side, or if you're a former officer, you want to enlist, come on over. Right. And so I kind of ran through the wickets. It took me about 18 months to get in the Air Force. I wrote like resumes and had interviews with just random, you know, Charlie Rapp and like some like old chiefs. I'm like, this is the strangest process. And then it just showed up at MEPS one day.
18 months.
Yeah. So I kind of pursued it. And like I said, I separated completely, but it was a, you know, having worked as a civilian, right. And as a young man, right. I was 25, 26. You know, you're not surrounded with the same kind of level of motivated individuals, the same caliber of individuals, the same people that, you know, there's just something about the way that we view life, regardless of your soft branch, even just military, right? I think there's a inherent sense of service that we have, an inherent sense of drive, right? Intrinsic motivation. You don't find that as much on the outside. And so I missed that, and I wanted to be back in that, and I knew that special operations, I thought was going to be a good call, and it was.
I would agree. Look at you now.
Look at me now. Look at me now.
Look at us now. Who would have thought? Not me.
That's awesome. Maybe I missed it. What year was that you did the transfer? I know you said you went to Iraq, but that was as a National Guard dude.
Yep. So I joined the Air Force in 07, in November of 07.
So your first assignment was over to Mildenhall with us.
Yep. That's correct. So yeah, went through the pipeline, right? You know, at the time it was the orientation course. So CCT had separated from Indoc by that time. So I went to the orientation course, showed up, you know, day one or night one, I guess, woke up with an excruciating pain in my inguinal crease on the right side of my body.
Oh, so tight.
Clear, So clearly, Nick Seibel, Ben Hubbard, and Jared Antoni, these guys were like, we broke you. Look, we broke this. And I'd been to Ranger school. I'd been airborne and been in the infantry. I was like, something's wrong here. They're like, torn hip flexor. So, you get the Motrin diagnosis. And it's like, all right, well, so get my red cherry helmet and I'm walking around. They're like, you're a good dude. Like, clearly we just broke you because you can't flutter kick. It's like, clearly.
That must have been it.
24 hours later, right? Remember how we used to carry the Gatorade bottles with the white tape on them that had your name? I don't know if you guys had to do that, but
Oh, bro.
I hope we still do that, right?
Don't get peaches started on taping that water bottle correctly.
You need to make sure you mark there's one thing correctly.
Hey, attention to detail, right? If you can't figure out a stencil on a piece of tape, like, maybe special operations is not your jam.
I can't trust you on target if I can't trust that water bottle to look neat and tidy, dog. Come on, man. Everybody knows this.
So there I am, 5 a.m., kind of waking up, getting ready to go to formation, take the morning piss, and it's just straight blood. And I'm like, oh, my God. The only thing I have good. To, for proof is my water bottle. So I dump that thing out, and I pee in it. And sure enough, here I've got this, 1 quart water bottle full of bloody urine, and
that's a single use water bottle at this point, too. Time you use that water bottle. So
good news, replaceable. I mean, it's really a motivation. You could reuse it. And so I passed a kidney stone on day one of the orientation course, or was in the midst of it. So anyway, rolled back. Fortunately, not too long. I joined in November of 2007, and I was a beret wearing combat controller in September of 2008. So it didn't set me back that far. Less than a year.
Well, so how did you feel like being Mildenhall? Generally, I would not think that being in overseas, whether it's Mildenhall or Kadena, would be a good kind of first term CCT, PJ, SR, TACP, because there's a lot to learn overseas. Like, we're sending people out kind of on their own, maybe in groups of two, maybe to other countries. And, granted, I guess you had a different perspective because you were cross-training. You'd already lived life. You already, probably around 25?
So at that point, I was 29.
Yeah. You know what you're doing. I'm not saying you're not gonna go do something stupid, but the chances
we did dumb shit.
Yeah. I was gonna say, I can't believe you were there. You know the dumb stuff. Like,
no,
yeah.
I wasn't. I was not there.
Well, you were not. Yeah, let me clarify. You weren't there with me doing the dumb thing. You usually had to explain to people why I was doing the dumb thing. So my bad. Yeah. As we talked before.
We are within special operations. We are very driven, right? Like, that is even one of the attributes through the new ANS process. Like, hey, we need drive. Criminals are also very driven, right? So
they are.
Hopefully we get the ethically driven people and not the financially driven or other version. But to answer your question, Peaches, I was a little bit more senior. I had time in the military. I had time on Earth. I was married. Right. And so I volunteered to go to England. I was born and raised overseas as well. So I was not uncomfortable living overseas. My wife was born and raised in Houston, Texas, and she was wanted to travel. And I said, hey, if we put this down, we're going to go. Right. At the time, it was, Generation Jaguar, right? Like, everybody just wanted to get downrange and sling bombs. And we did that from England as well and Okinawa, but we had additional commitments through the partnership exercises, joint training exchange exercises, the big Joint Chiefs of Staff exercises. And then obviously kind of some of the administrative commitments to supporting the theater with our survey capability. And the partnerships. So we would travel around doing that stuff. So it was a great opportunity. Maybe I got one or two less pumps to Afghanistan, slinging hate in a nowhere valley. But I loved it. I loved being overseas. And I thought it was a great first assignment. But to answer your question, I think it does require a little bit an increased sense of maturity, minimally a sense of maturity to go over there. Technically, we'll get you where you need to be, but you got to understand the environment you're in, that strategic senior airman that can shit his pants and get you on a first name basis with some chief of mission, some ambassador, is not a comfortable position to be in. So.
Yeah.
Well, like no other, you know, we talk about it often, but in our career fields in special operations, you're going to have a whole lot of responsibility way lower down the chain. You know, to have an E4 that can, no kidding, foul a relationship with an entire region, which can happen and has happened, you know, people have, you know, bad relationships and bad goes of it. Man, that stuff can happen, but we will make, like, we have E4s that bear that responsibility and then, you know, have the authority that comes along with it. Like, it's not a joke. We put people in those positions a lot. We glossed over your pipeline. Like, we talk a lot of, it's great here. We get to talk about pipeline stories all the time. Like, the way that you tell stories as an operator in the career fields, right? Like, everything is high school, you know, before you get to, you know, your selection. Then it's all selection until you get to a deployment. Then you get a couple deployments, and then it's all pipeline stuff again. You go all the way back. Like, you regress. That's the only stories you tell. But you had the benefit of being, you know, with your military service before. You had a clear vision of what you wanted to do, an idea. You had that life experience you talked about. Now that you were doing it at the 321st, looking back, did you forecast correctly? Like, how did you feel when you actually made it through combat control? You're no kidding, combat controller on that path at the 321st. How did you feel that you called it way back in the day when you made this life-changing decision, you know, 2 years, 3 years beforehand?
Man, it was gratifying, right? And so the pipeline, if you want to talk about the pipeline, was a little bit different back then, right? The free fall portion, the dive portion was done at advanced skills training, not in the pipeline. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons I was able to kind of make it through in 10, 11 months. But I think that, and having come from an infantry background, you know, a lot of the skills that we are training any of our special warfare airmen are common land warfare skills, right? Shoot, move, communicate, basic medicate, basic administrate, right? Like those are gear common to all. And so coming from the Army, man, I had 99% of that stuff. You could throw me in a map, you know, with a map and compass in the woods and I'll get to where I need to go. I knew how to, you know, what was the acronym before March, but you know, I could treat a casualty. I could put somebody on a litter. I could, you know, fire a weapon from an M9 up to, you know, a 50 cal. Like, and so really it was the air traffic control piece, the global access, understanding the survey piece. And then at the time the demand was JTAC, right? So we were pumping guys in. It's like, if you had the aptitude, you understood the three-dimensional airspace, we would put guys into the JTAC program. And so, very quickly after I got to Mildenhall, I mean, I had to hit ALS en route. So coming out of the Army, I was an E5. The Air Force saw that as being equivalent to being an A1C. And so I was an A1C for a little while.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate that.
Yeah, solid. So I was a Ranger tab E3 in the Air Force, which was, you know, I thought it was great. It's never been about the money, right? But it was great to people look at you and be like, did you like get in a fight or something? I'm like, clearly, yeah.
Right, yeah.
You know, made E4, they re-recorded some paperwork, made E4. And then they were like, hey, yo, you're eligible to take this test for E5. And I was like, test? What are you talking about? Like, you know, when you promote in the Army, I went in front of a board, physical board, they reviewed my records. I, you know, they you do facing movements and you get put on the hot seat with questions and stuff like that. You're in your service greens, right? Your class A's at the time. They changed their uniform now, but so I took the test and they were like, oh man, you got promoted. And I was like, this is the most bizarre, like, this is how you're evaluating my leadership skills. Cause I studied the professional development guide, the PDG, and I knew which fringe went on a ceremonial flag and all this, like some of the questions, you're like, this is bizarre. But, and so I got there and had to go to Airman Leadership School, right? And so again, like anything that takes you away from that tactical, you know, opportunity, you're like kicking rocks about, right? You know, yeah, I went to ALS, like I should be able to waive this, like. But you go to ALS, you meet good humans from the rest of the service, right? So we are very isolated from from our larger service. It's something I'm learning very clearly here at, you know, as the CFM, but we are isolated from our service, right? You look down on the, your left chest pocket and it says, you know, U.S. Air Force. It doesn't say U.S. SOCOM. It doesn't say CCT or PJ or AFSPEC War. And we don't really acknowledge that maybe as much as we should or understand that, right? Like that's our parent service. So go to ALS, you know, and then right in the new year, went to JTAC QC to the qualification course in Germany. And so I think that, man, I was, again, being a little bit more mature, I think I was given a little bit more opportunity, understanding, having come in with a little bit of, background. And then initiated the JTAC training and was given a lot of good opportunities, had a lot of great mentors. Peaches was one of my mentors. I wish it's at work right now. I was going to bring in my CFETP, my career field education and training plan. And I've got Tech Sergeant Jared Petrus in there as one of the signatures signing me off. And I can't remember what we did. We probably went to Sculthorpe or something to work traffic.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
That's, so, I would not be here today if Jared Petrus had not trained me. And I've got the documentation to prove it. Right? So nice. Thank you, Peaches.
To explain out there what this is. So back in the day, because again, we're old. I think that's the through line of this entire episode is that you're talking to three older dudes. But so we have this book, right? Where that's how we track training. Like you have your CFETP, your career field education and training plan. And it was essentially a big long list of stuff. And you had to have somebody that was qualified sign you off. So you go back through here. There was a page on the front and it had everybody's name that was allowed to sign off your book. Like they'd have to put their name and then what their initials look like. Cause you'd be like, whose initials are these? And you go to page one, you'd be like, oh, that guy's dumb. but when you go back and you look, like you have a bunch of people throughout your career that train you, it's crazy to go back and look at that sheet and go, oh, wow. You know, Tech Sergeant Jared Petrus did train, you know, Tech Sergeant Robbie Bean did, you know, this training for me. And I worked for him as a chief, you know, way later in my career as well. So it's a weird nostalgic thing to look at that. But it does bring up a fun thing. We always talk about, you know, you're learning all the time. You're a constant student. How did it feel when you were a student? You're in that student mode, whether it be JTAC QC or, you know, Airman Leadership School, what have you. How did it feel being a student when you're an actual operator as opposed to, you know, in the pipeline, in that 100% like tech training mindset?
Yeah. So I think that once you kind of step out of the pipeline, right, and something, so Aaron, good news, we still have CFETPs. We still do that process. So if you are a candidate out there, if you're a pipeline stud, you know, you're this book, you might not have been introduced to it yet, but it's coming. Just don't you wait. It's coming. And that's one of the things as a CFM I adjudicate on, right, is what skills to what proficiency do we need at what point in an airman's career. So, but back to your question, Aaron, I think when you're surrounded by other trainees or your instructors are all you know, kind of controllers, J's, you know, AFSPEC War, and then you step out of that into something like ALS, you realize, you know, what was maybe mediocre in a previous peer group is now superior performance, right? And so went to ALS. And here's folks that had been, you know, in the Air Force for, you know, 3 to 5 years generally is kind of the cohort. And again, you know, I'm stepping in and thinking, okay, they're going to teach me about the Air Force. And I was just like, holy cow. You know, and so again, I was a little bit older and they were like, you're going to be the class leader. I was like, all right, well, right on, let's do this. And you know, basic things like troop leading procedures, they had not generally been introduced to because they're trained based on their technical expertise. That's what the Air Force focuses on versus some of the other services, right? So they were very good, you know, journeymen at their craft, but they, I found them kind of somewhat lacking in overall leadership ability. And the Air Force has recognized this as well. So being able to step up and then the confidence to take charge, right? So it's something that we seek in our candidates. It's something we promote. It's knowing when to take charge, knowing when to advocate, knowing when to advise, right? We all work for a commander. We're all enlisted. Every one of us works for a commander. And our role is to advise those commanders at every level. So I think that was kind of what I noticed going to these courses. I went to a JTAC QC course, right? I didn't go to a SOTAC course. The qualification on the back end is the same, but it's just the cohort that you attend that training with. So that was the first time I'd done like big Air Force training.
Well, I mean, that's because you just do joint training. I mean, it's natural right. to us. It's inherent to us, especially when you start talking about the joint terminal attack controller. So, got a kind of weird question for you. And it's not weird, actually. It's right in line with what we're trying to get after. But I guess it was 2016, 2017, something like that, we had the ST-2030 vision. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, I'd have to go through and figure out how much of that actually came true, even though we're not in 2030 yet. But like, as you look at that document right now, we are in a very different place than what that is. And I understand that that's a guess. You know, we're just trying to read the tea leaves and figure out, you know, what the future is going to look like. But as it sits right now, I don't think that there's a ST or an aspect war, you know, 2040 or anything like that. So what do you kind of, from a big picture, see where aspect war is going? Or if you want to specifically go CCT, that's fine too. But where do you kind of see us going here in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, so the Air Force, the 2030 vision, right? We were pretty heavy into GWAT, right? We were ISIS. We'd done the revision in 2014, 2015. Different ice cream, different flavor, same ice cream type thing. Now we're looking at different responsibilities, right? So when we look at force development and force design into what we need to do in the future to execute in the future, you know, this is coming. This is from the Air Force all the way down. The Air Force is looking at, hey, are we task organized the way we need to, the way we need to be? So special tactics. Here's one of the issues we have, right? So we have Air Force Special Warfare, which is this umbrella, and we have special tactics. Then we have battlefield airmen. Then we have Air Commando, JTAC, Controller, PJ. Like, it is no wonder that we have an issue with branding when we were getting these young men and women to be like, hey, what do you want to do? And they're like, yes. And so because we identify with our tribe, right, at various echelons. And so, you know, the 2030 vision, what is special tactics going to be? Special tactics being the special operations portion of AFSPEC war. We have other portions of AFSPEC war, which is the Guardian Angel weapon system, right? PJs will sit in both. And then you have the TAC-P weapon system, and they will also sit in both ST and the TAC-P weapon system, but most of their forces, right, are in the TAC-P weapon system. So, you know, they are, you know, what is the Guardian Angel weapon system doing going forward? You know, and with it, they call it the triad, right? The HH-60s, the HC-130s, and the PJs. You know, is that the force structure that's needed? So that's being evaluated. The TAC-P weapon system. Okay, do we need, you know, TAC-Ps doing air support operations activities at the battalion level, right? Does it stay at the brigade level? Does it go to the brigade division level? Does it stay at the corps level, right? And so they are going through, they have evaluated and said, hey, we can provide this airspace control, airspace operations at higher echelons, meaning, hey, we can do this at the division of corps. So they are actually reducing their force numbers right now. ST, Special Tactics, and AFSOC is looking to say, hey, we want to spread you guys out a little bit further. We will have our special tactics squadrons, but there's other formations that we're looking at, theater air operations squadrons, to say, hey, look at problems left of conflict, right? And that's what SOF was really designed to do. And we, as the air component of SOF, right, we have very tangible, you know, phase zero, if we want to talk doctrinally, right? But skills, we can go into partner nations. Our job is to work by, with, and through partners and allies, and we can train them how to conduct technical rescue, how to conduct, you know, combat casualty care, how to leverage their airspace and their aircraft, right? And so we are very fortunate in that we have, you know, airplanes coming out the yin yang. But when you talk about a lot of these other countries, like they might only have 10 or 15 cargo aircraft and 30 fighter aircraft, right? And so the way that we would leverage those aircraft from our perspective, it's a much different risk calculus for them. And so we have to go in there as mature operators, understand what their value proposition is to their own country. Hey, what can we, what experience can we bring? And help train you to become, or to maintain being that partner of choice. Right. So, we are the contact layer, right? Whether that's the human contact layer, right? So whether that is, you know, in conflict and working with partner forces. I mean, we've all worked alongside Iraqi, you know, Afghan, pick your African country, right? We don't go out there unilaterally. We go out there with partners, right? With both joint partners, so Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and then with foreign partners and allies. And we all, you know, participate. So that's what I think where we're going forward is how do we strengthen those relationships outside of conflict. Now, what we have to leverage is our strength in bona fides, right? So we have 20 plus years of conflict, and we are seen as not only technical experts in what we do, but we value human life differently than maybe a different partner would, right? And so if you look at, you know, it's no secret we would go train in the Indo-Pacific region, and you know, a few weeks after we would be there, China would come in with their military and want to train, but they approach life with a different risk calculus, right? And so, so that we are valued because we, one, are very technically competent, and two, that we demonstrate we value the lives of our partners, and so that's where I think that that's where we're going in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. But we're always ready for conflict, right? Yeah. We're always going to be ready when the klaxon sounds, and we're going to be again, we'll be right there at the tip of the spear, ready to go.
Yeah, and that's kind of what the value proposition of SOF is that our ability to flex to whatever our nation needs. I mean, yeah, okay. So, you know, doctrinally, I guess you would say that we make our money in phase zero, phase one, but you know, we are integral in all the phases of kind of warfare, military operations. Man, being able to, you covered a lot there. That's what I'm trying to digest.
I talk a lot. Sorry.
It's also why you're the CFM. Yeah. So then if we're talking about the kind of precision strike and the JTAC thing, like you brought up JTAC a couple of times. So is the JTAC, the Joint Terminal Attack Control qualification, still a viable thing for CCT?
Absolutely. So we are still training guys in JTAC. It's just a different ratio, right? So, you know, when Jared, when you and I were operational, it was probably 80% of the career field. I don't have a ratio now, but it's probably 30% of the career field that we try to maintain that qualification. It's a great access vector, right? Other countries want us to teach them about fire support. And then we, you know, again, we, in phase zero, we don't conduct CAS. In phase one, probably not, right? But we start getting into phase two. And you can look at the conflicts going around the world, right? We cannot shift everything towards great power competition, especially on the soft side. I mean, we are not to nerd out about our chain of command, right? But our administrative, our civilian leadership, right, is literally titled the SOLIC, right? Low intensity conflict. That's what special operations and low intensity conflict. That's where SOF is designed to operate. And so whether that is, you know, that can be anywhere in the world. So we have just been used most recently in the main lines of effort. So I don't know if
yeah, that is unusual. That is not how we are supposed to be used. It's just when you find yourself that because we're the easy button, right? Because we can flex. We are always training. We're always prepared. We're always, you know, qualified and current, if you will. We may not always be proficient in every aspect of everything that we've got to have, but it is easy, and we're always ready to rip out the door and go do, you know, whatever our nation needs us to do. So we are kind of the easy button, and you can rely on us a lot. And when you start talking about the last 20 years of conflict, we have, you know, pretty sharpened edges, if you will. Like, we're just pretty tactically sound just because we've had to, out of all the repetitions we've had. So then you've said global access a couple times. I know that there's a new name that we're kind of either exploring. I don't know if the table slap has happened, but it's a force projection, right?
Sure. Yeah.
sure.
We can.
You're like, yeah, okay, I guess.
Call it.
How,
you know.
I love how you painted him into a corner and then didn't even allow him to, like, and then you hit him with the name. You could be That's like, right. hey, yeah. is that good now or no? You didn't even give me out. I like it. Good job, Peaches.
yeah. No. Force projection. Agile combat employment. Global access. Right. These are terms that the Air Force throws around, and but the functions that airmen provide to execute these tasks have not changed, right? The technical skills, the leadership understanding, you know, how do you manage something at the forward edge of battle? Those have not changed, right? Those are foundational, and we can argue in the eaches and what gets written in the doctrine documents. I think that's something that, you know, we as combat control, right? That's what we were built to do originally under Military Airlift Command and later AMC before we were 100% soft. And so, you know, going back to that, I mean, we were all trained as air traffic. Well, there was a time where combat control was not all air traffic controllers, but this is something that we have, you know, candidly let atrophy a little bit. It hasn't gone away altogether, but bringing that back to the forefront, because that is our value proposition in force projection, in global access, and the Air Force and the Joint Force really needs to develop that, because it's a hard problem. It's a tough problem.
Yeah. Switching gears a little bit, along with that evolution, you know, the evolution of ST in mind and where we're going, there's a consolidation that we've been going on. You know, the entire Air Force, by the way, has been looking at, you know, how many bases do we have? How many UTCs? Like, how many actual people do we have and enough equipment to actually get after the mission? And can we consolidate that? You saw it with, you know, the Nellis unit getting deactivated fiscal year 24. So those dudes are out as the rescue unit. So the 58th, you know, deactivated, and those PJs went and found different places, you know, in AFSOC and AETC and, you know, other rescue units. But as we go through our own consolidation on the AFSOC side of it, how do you feel like that makes us more efficient going forward? And you can, like, I didn't say any, you know, specific base or any specific place on purpose. You can talk as freely as you want, because you're the man. I'm just a dude with a podcast. But I did want to give you the out, unlike Peaches didn't. So I'm not talking about one place in specific.
Yeah. So geolocation of forces, right? If you co-locate forces, there's economies of scale there, economies of scale with training resources, with training assets, potentially with venues, right? Strength in numbers is kind of the idea. Now, we are over in terms of the Air Force and infrastructure. You know, we're about a 330,000 member active duty service now. And so we are still supporting infrastructure, beyond that, right? You know, Jeff's opinion is there's something to be gained with economies of scale. And I don't think from a mathematical standpoint that you can argue that. You know, again, those ranges, assets, and venues we need to train, are we appropriately co-located with those, or are we going to spend, you know, treasure to TDY our forces to a specific venue. Now, obviously, we're going to have to travel to train, but are we doing that smartly? So those are some of the things that I and the other CFMs advocate for, right? So there's things that, from a functional management perspective, we can advocate for. But then we also, you know, that a lot, some of those decisions are in the operational realm, right? So forces have to be co-located in a specific locale for threat response, let's say. So there's the reason, you know, it'd be much easier to bring our forces back from overseas and train them in the CONUS. However, we need a air quotes threshold force should crisis occur. So how do we appropriately balance that? How do we, you know, we don't station forces in central command, right? We rotate forces. So, you know, is a rotational force model more effective, more efficient? You know, how does it affect the career field health down to the psyche of the individual airman performing the task, right? If what we run into is if airmen don't think that they're being utilized or utilized to their greatest extent, they're going to leave, right? Especially in special warfare, we have high performing individuals. They're going to be successful wherever they go. And so we have to ensure that we're providing them the opportunities that they came in for, as well as, you know, serving the needs of those geographic combatant commanders on down.
Gotcha. And then speaking specifically to those, you know, you kind of mentioned the retention piece there in a second and trying to really give the people that are under your charge what they came in to do, right? Now that gets a little bit hard, you know, especially when you start talking about, like, we hear folks all the time like, oh, I got in to drop bombs and kick doors in. And you're like, hey man, like I give my best answer, but you know, honestly, I don't really have a whole lot of good answers. What answer would you give to that question of, or you know, that more nuance of like, okay, you want to give somebody what they came in to do, but you know, is there expectation management that goes on from your end? How do you communicate it?
Sure. I think it's get the message out of what the guys and gals are doing right now, right? We all know, like, we can all tell GWAT stories and Aaron, you know, was plugging holes in bodies and Jared and I were dropping bombs, but that's not the reality for the next generation, right? So what is the reality? Hey, we're going more towards a teaming construct, right? And so the special tactics teams, at least within AFSOC, are employing as a team, anywhere from 8 to 14 members. And so that's a little bit different mindset shift for both commanders and for the individuals. The skills that we need you to learn are identical, right? It's just who's on your left and right when you execute that skill. Is it going to be a Green Beret or a SEAL, or is it going to be another airman? Right now we're moving towards, hey, it's going to be another airman. It has nothing to do with the competence of your skill though. And so if you are a potential candidate, if you're in the dev pool, if you're, you know, in the pipeline, these are the things that worry about the things that you can worry about and becoming a good, you know, three level, completing the apprentice course, right? Becoming a five level, there would be opportunities. And this is one thing that I can't stress enough. The opportunities that you might have signed up for may never present themselves, but there will be amazing opportunities that none of us can broadcast and project, right? And so, you know, we have the benefit, I think, within the Air Force Special Warfare community. We do a lot of humanitarian assistance, disaster relief. Those skills, when you talk about crisis, when you talk about incident site management, when you talk about command and control, those are foundational to what we do. And we can do that in conflict, or we can do that in a humanitarian scenario. No other soft component does that, right? They don't do that. They might run a med cap. They might, you know, so we are foundational, and we are able to leverage the greatest assistance through air power, right? And so if you want opportunities, we're not kicking in doors, right? We're not dropping as many bombs. And I spent a long time up at our national force, right? Where those missions will still exist, right? They will just exist on a much smaller scale. But from a theater special operations side, from a, you know, the 2-1, the 2-2, the 2-3, the 2-6, right? These units, they are out there getting after it. And, you know, a near recent case, tragically, right? We had a V-22 that crashed in Indo-PACOM, right? The first members that were U.S. members that were on scene, able to, and took over scene incident site management, was a special tactics team from the 320th. NSW was there. USASOC was there, right? The 31st Rescue and the 33rd Rescue were there, and they were assisting. And so when they needed to splash divers on that wreck, they were STS divers, because we had the equipment, we had the training, we had the expertise to go initiate the recovery of those heroes. So it's kind of a tragic event, but it demonstrates that through the training and through the grit of our forces, right, that these opportunities will exist. And they're not going to be, you know, they don't make great recruiting videos sometimes, but know that, yeah, but know that those opportunities are out there, and guys are doing great stuff in Europe right now. Guys are doing great stuff in Africa right now. But it just doesn't, again, a lot of it's classified, and it just doesn't make the unclassed sit reps. I don't know if that helps answer.
No, that does. So what I don't want to do is I don't want to ambush you, because I promise you that I would not ambush you. So I'm going to ask you if you want to talk about this.
I've been ambushed before, Peaches. I've been ambushed before. So
this is not an L ambush.
This is a far ambush. You can just shut your computer and we disappear. It's an easy one.
So you can talk about it if you want, because I definitely don't want to set you up. But you talked about, you know, splashing divers, you know, off the coast to recover the CV-22. Dive school for CCT and SR. Like, do you want to touch on that at all?
Sure, I'll talk about it. So the requirement to have every combat controller and SR airman and special tactics officer be a combat diver was removed, right? That does not mean we don't need combat divers and we don't need divers. So part of the calculus there was it's taking too long to get our airmen through the pipeline. We need to get our airmen through the pipeline faster. Okay, great. So what we've done is that has been removed as a 3-level training requirement for the AFSOC forces. However, there is still water competence that needs to be demonstrated, right? So whether or not you're going subsurface, like I still need to be able to, you know, derig a Ram B in high sea state. I still need you to be able to conduct surface swim. If you've ever been under the rotor wash of a V-22 in the water, significant emotional event, right? And so we have to ensure that our airmen are prepared for that. We use dive school as that measuring stick, and particularly combat dive. Now, there is a kind of a get well plan. Right now, every operational combat controller, SR, and STO are dive qualified, right? But that will atrophy through time. Soon we will get airmen that will graduate that are not dive. We have to ensure that commanders maintain a dive capability. So Air Force Special Operations is working through what that requirement is. It will be a significant portion of the force. In order to ensure that we have a capability, it will be a significant portion of the force, right? Kind of like JTAC. And it will still, you know, it's one of those things, okay, do we stair step it? You know, there was a time where PJs did not conduct closed circuit dive operations because it was not a requirement, right? They had a salvage and recovery requirement. And so they said, hey, I'm going to cut 2 weeks of training off and you guys aren't going to see this this Mark 25. Okay, you know, that was a risk calculus that was done. And then we came back through and said, hey, you know, cost benefit, we just keep these guys, they're already here. Just tag on another 2 weeks of training and then it's just a refresher at this point. Like, so, but I think what we're doing across dive and in a lot of our technical skills, right, is we're ruthlessly prioritizing at what proficiency and at what point in an airman's career on the force development timeline do we train airmen to do these things? And does every airman need it, right? One thing that really we struggle with is is scale, right? And so, not to go into specific numbers, but there's just not that many of us across onesie one, onesie two, and onesie four. So TACP, and TACP has taken some cuts, right? And so, we have to ensure that those airmen, it becomes a very difficult talent management project if it's like, well, okay, well, this airman is dive qualified, but he's not JTAC qualified. Oh, but I need a free fall jump master. Do we have any tandem bundle guys? Like, hey, has this guy been to the, like, what's his proficiency with, you know, is he a seven level? Like, so it's easier to just load everybody up with the training. Now that's costly and time consuming and everything. So it's kind of this balance. And this is where the functional management community, guys like me, your MAGCOM functional managers, will kind of butt heads with the operational, with the commanding portion of the environment. Commanders want it all, right? Like, oh, I need my airmen need to be able to do full spectrum operations. I'm like, yep, got it. Totally 100% agree. It takes me, you know, this is the time it takes, and this is the money it takes to get an airman there. And they're like, oh, well, we can't do that. And it's like, all right, well, let's talk about risk, right? This is what we do. Commanders adjudicate risk. So, and some of that talks about at what portion of the force and at what competency do we train those airmen. So I hope that answers your question about the dive piece. I did write the interim, or it's not interim, it is the water competence standards now that are being conducted. We will send those airmen, any airman that comes in today, you will go through the pre-scuba course. If you pass the pre-scuba course, you're good to go. If there are certain events in that course, if you do not pass, things like buddy breathing, things like ditch and don, which are generally higher attrition portions that are specific to dive, right? If those are not passed, you will continue on your training. And when you, if and when you need to conduct dive training, you will have to repeat those or demonstrate that you can, you know, execute those events, if that makes sense. So if you're the pipeline stud right now, work hard, pass pre-dive. And if you don't, just know in the future, you might have to do it again. So
if you no, guys that's are like good. Me, that saved like me from twice. Asking that.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Cause I was about to, as soon as you're going to close up, I was going to go, how about WaterCon? But yeah, that's yeah. Perfect. Yep. That's, you nailed it.
Yeah. Don't worry. The wizard is still out there, man.
Oh yeah. He's floating around with his wand and he's ready to pounce on you.
Yeah,
he is.
Yeah. Yeah.
This
yeah.
Just closing in.
He's ready to get you. So
he's lurking yeah. In the deep end of that pool. Okay. Yeah. Well, Jeff, I really appreciate it. All the candid answers and then you coming on. What we generally like to do is because of who is usually watching us is, you know, folks that are looking to join Aspect War. A lot of them are in high school, college, but what piece of advice would you give them before joining?
Yeah. So I think it's, it can be intimidating, right? Especially if you're not from a military family, you don't know what you don't know. I think that take the leap. I joined and I have stayed because I like the people I'm around. The technical things I've been able to do are gratifying, but especially as you become more senior, you know, I think you're going to want to surround yourself with like-minded people. So, you know, if you're going to one of these dev sessions, if you're in ROTC and you're seeing, if you have the opportunity to, you know, meet or talk with a current active duty member or guard and reserve, right? So we total force, and you see yourself having similar mindset and a similar value system, come on out. Like the technical skills, the water con, we joke about it. You know, but we'll train you to execute those things. You know, I'm a cross trainee. Aaron's a cross trainee. Peaches is one of the few that is not a cross trainee, right? And the other thing is, if you're if you're in the active service, right, or guard or reserves, and you want to cross train, please reach out to your functional manager. I sit with all the other career field managers for the 1Z community. There's a career field called 9Z, which is special warfare mission support, right? So I sit with that career field manager as well. Reach out to us, right? I've got a unique last name, somewhat of a unique first name. So I'm the only one. I will not shame you. I will not, and I will point you in the right direction. So, and Jared, you guys can post my email, my us.if.mil email on the bottom there. But I think that's, there's a lot of fear of the unknown. But we wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't be able to conduct a podcast like this, if there wasn't a great community ready to accept you on the other side. Now, we're going to smash you a little bit. We're going to make sure that you got the attributes and the drive and the technical skills to get there. But just understand that that is just a step in the road, and it's a much longer road after that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Throwing out your old official email, huh? Okay.
Bold move, gotten.
Yeah. Official yeah. email, fine. I'm just glad you're not like, hey, yeah, my phone number is 702. Well, yeah. Awesome, Jeff. Really appreciate you joining us. I know that you're busy, especially being the career field functional. I mean, that's a hell of a job. So better you than me.
Hey, Jared, what are you doing after weapons school?
Yeah, that's a great question. Ron, you've been asking me that.
Okay, hit the button, yeah. Hang up. Sorry, technical difficulties were out. Bye. Yeah. Okay, bye. Yeah, bye.
I think I am the. Am I the longest? Currently, the longest serving CCT, like pure CCT, I think.
Yeah, because you came in what, 03, 02?
99.
Oh yeah, then you are. You are definitely the longest blue blood.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got some cross trainees that might have you by a couple of years, but they haven't been controllers as long as you have.
Good so. God!
Yeah, you old. But technically, you know, you fill in that 9 golf role now, so I'm not going to get into it, but
you're not going to go into the specifics about uniform wear or anything here.
Yeah,
but.
You're like super important, and the rest of us are just still rocking that 1Z2.
Yeah, right. All right, man. Well, I appreciate you joining us. Everybody out there, don't forget to like, subscribe, hit that notification bell, and then check us out on onesready.com. Get yourself a flag, shirt, whatever. And then if you happen to go over to iTunes, leave us a review, Spotify, just hit that stars, 5 of them, or whatever you feel is appropriate. All right, we're out here. Light up.
Later.